today is August 2nd, 2017. My name is Monica Brown, and this afternoon I'll be interviewing Mr. William Yoss. This interview is being conducted in person at the Clyde W. Cosper Texas State Veterans Home in Bonham, Texas. This interview is being conducted in support of the Texas Veterans Land Board Voices of Veterans Oral History Program. Thank you, Mr. Yoss, for taking the time to talk to us today. It is an honor for us. So I'd like to start off these conversations with is, can you tell me where and when were you born?
I was born in McAlester, Oklahoma, December 26, 1930, day after Christmas.
What were your parents' names?
My mother was Loma Louise Nation, N-A-T-I-O-N, and my dad was William Henry Yoss, Y-O-S-S.
Now, did you grow up on a farm?
No, I grew up in town, but my grandparents had a farm, and I spent lots of time out there. And my grandfather immigrated to this country from Switzerland in 1894. And in fact, he had a sister and that didn't immigrate, so I've still got some distant relatives over there. And I have an aunt that has visited back and forth with them over the years. Spent the biggest part of my summers out there, and they had dairy cattle and raised feed. And he talks about his trip. He says they got on the train and rode the train from Bern, Switzerland to Hamburg, Germany. And he said they got on a boat and they traveled under steam until they got out into the Atlantic, and then they traveled under sail until they got close to the coast and then went under steam again.
How did he end up coming to Texas?
He first wound up in Pennsylvania, and then there was a family that had been friends in the old country in Switzerland that needed some help on their farm. So he and his brother, that was in Missouri, and he and his brother came to Missouri and worked on that farm. And then after they got of age, they had come to Oklahoma, which at that time was Indian Territory, and had worked in the zinc mines. And then it came up that there was 10-acre homesteads that could be had in Pittsburgh County. And so he and his brother went down and homesteaded two 10-acre plots adjoining. And of course, over the years, they later purchased land around him. And by the time he died, I think he had about, between the two farms was about 120, 130 acres.
Did you know much about the military, or had you heard anything about World War II?
We were very cognizant of World War II because I had I had two uncles on my mother's side that in the military. One of them was in the Normandy invasion and got wounded, and the other was in the medical corps, and he was in with the group that liberated Dachau prison.
Goodness.
And so they told quite a few stories. In fact, my uncle that was in the invasion was awarded a Bronze Star and wounded once like that. And of course, in 1948, it was, because I had, in 48, I just turned 18. Well, let's see, 1948, I just turned 17 at the beginning. And you could join the National Guard at 17. And so a bunch of us in our senior class went down and joined the National Guard because we were getting $10 a month. And of course, we were in that in 1940 when Korean War broke out, which was on June 25th, 1940, that North Korea invaded South Korea. And we got called to active duty on the first day of August. Well, we got what they call activated.
Okay, so
it's a form of being drafted, but you were already in a reserve unit. And then,
And so that was in
August of 50.
Okay,
August of 50, we got our orders.
What was the reaction of your family when you got called up? Yeah. And they were okay?
I don't think that there was much reaction or anything. I mean, you know.
It was kind of the norm.
Yeah, it was pretty much the norm.
I mean, you were already in the National Guard, so.
Yeah.
And you knew that you might get called up at some point mm-hmm. if something happened. Did you have any brothers or sisters?
I have one brother. He was in the Army, but he got drafted also, but that was later. And as far as going overseas, he was in the Signal Corps and he went to Hawaii, and that was his overseas duty.
Oh, my goodness. So were you still living in Oklahoma at the time?
I was.
When you joined the National Guard, did you have to go to boot camp?
No, we'd go to camp every year.
Oh, but you didn't have to go to boot camp.
No, we didn't have to go to, well, basically it was a type of boot camp.
Right.
But it wasn't like the regular Army boot camp.
When you got called up, mm-hmm. then did you have to go to regular boot camp?
Well, it was, you had already had some military experience, so it was a, more or less learning your position, you know. Like, we were combat engineers, but we got called into infantry, so we had training on both ends of it, engineer training and infantry training, too.
Where did you go for your training?
Camp Polk, Louisiana. And it was Camp Polk. It's now Fort Polk now, but then it had been closed since World War II, and we went down there and opened it up.
Going back, what made you decide to pick the Army National Guard?
It's $10 a month we
okay.
got while
so
we were in high school.
Yeah, it was $10. So,
and it was the thing to do, everybody, you know.
Right. So when you got called up to active duty, how much money did you get a month?
I really don't remember. I think it was, seemed to me like it was about right at $100.
Okay.
And it was according to your rank. And I'd already made the rank of corporal when I was in the National Guard, and when I got in, I was promoted to the rank of sergeant.
Do you remember any of your instructors that you had?
Yeah. Platoon sergeant was, he had been in World War II, so we had several what we call retreads that were World War II that had stayed in the National Guard and got called back in. In fact, most of our non-com corps, when we first got called in, were World War II veterans.
And so they had a lot of experience already.
Well, yeah, they had experience.
So, yes. Yeah. How did you pick your specialty, your job? Was it chosen for you?
I think we just, it was more or less chosen for us.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You didn't have your choice to say, well, I want to do this or I want to do that or thing.
When did you actually go over to Korea?
Well, when we first got called up, we took our basic at Camp Polk. And then when we got our orders, we were to go to Japan. So we went to New Orleans, got on a boat, went around, went through the Panama Canal, came back to San Francisco, picked up more troops, and then went across and landed at Muran, which is in Hokkaido, Japan, the northernmost island.
Do you remember the name of the ship?
William Weagle. I got a picture of it in my room. They were World War II Liberty ships built by the Kaiser Company, and they all looked alike. Yeah, yeah.
Have you ever been over there?
Never. I've been to Europe. I've been to Belgium and Holland and France. But that was in 1947 when they had, I was in the Boy Scouts and they held a World Jamboree, and I got to go to that World Jamboree, that Boy Scout.
Wow, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So you arrived in Muran, Japan?
Yeah, that was on the northernmost island of Hokkaido. And at that time, we were stationed there. The Russians held the Kurils and the Sakhalins, which were 1,100 yards across the strait from Hokkaido. And I know we kept a post up there to keep an eye, and you could actually look across the strait with a pair of real strong binoculars and see the Russian soldiers on the beach walking guard.
Goodness. So when did you go over to Korea?
Thanksgiving Day, 1951.
What was it like on your first day of arriving there?
Well, they didn't have any docks or anything, so we had to get off on a landing craft and go in and, you know, go ashore like that. Then when we got ashore, we had to immediately go to the rifle range to check out all our weapons and things like that. And then we, from there, we went right up to the, they had started the Panmunjom peace talks by then. And so we went up to the front line and relieved the 1st Cavalry Division.
And so you were right on the front lines first
day?
Oh,
yeah, yeah, we were right on the front lines, yeah.
Do you remember how many were in your squad?
The squad was 12 men, and there were 3 squads to a platoon, plus the support, you know, like support people, like the guy that took care of the arms, and you had your platoon leader and your platoon sergeants, assistant platoon sergeants, and like that. So you had 12 plus 3, 36 plus the support people, which I think amounted to about 44, 45, somewhere like that. 3 line platoons to a company, and then a headquarters platoon that, you know, all your cooks, your support group, supply and stuff like that.
So can you tell me about some of your experiences that you had?
We were just out of what they call mortar range and things like that for our staging areas, you know, where we had our kitchen supplies and stuff like that. And when we'd come off the front and we lived in the bunkers they made a pit, which was like about, I think it was about like 18 by 24. And it was 5 to 6 foot deep. And then you put a squad tent over that. And then we were lived in that when we were up on the front or doing patrol duty. And we did a lot of patrol duty because we were supposed to, at that time, we were supposed to have a mile buffer zone between the two lines. And of course, everybody was going out there probing back and forth. And that's when we suffered the most casualties.
And so you did come across enemy fire.
Do what?
You did come across.
Oh, yeah. It was more, you had very little small arms fire. It was more mortar fire and artillery fire like that. So, theirs was more mortar because we had superior artillery, and if they fired our artillery had more range, and so that we could, our forward observers could pick it up. So they used mortars, and mortars were more portable. They could move them because they usually had 3 men to a mortar team.
How did you get through that, the combat, going back and forth? With
through sheer luck and ignorance and being immature and not really realizing how serious things were.
And how long did you end up being over in Korea for?
6 months.
Do you know some of the battles that you participated in?
We're in, it was mainly for control of the Chulwon Valley because that was a natural pass to come out of an area of North Korea and into South Korea, because between the two countries there was a natural range of mountains. And this was the main pass that had been a trade route for centuries. And so this was what we were, you know, the main place we were defending. We had been up as far, when they were going back and forth, and before MacArthur got relieved, they'd been up as far as the Yellow River. And MacArthur and his arrogance, I might say, wanted to go on in and bring Red China into it and everything. And of course, they didn't want to start World War III because I'm deviating a little bit. That's when MacArthur got relieved, and then Ridgway came in and took over. And Ridgway was a much better general, he says, because he says, let's give them bullets instead of bayonets. In other words, he wanted to use long-range artillery, which we had superior force with, instead of trying to go up there and use sacrificing troops, you know. And so then they then they started the Pan Moon, like I say, they started the Pan Moon John Peace Talks, and they have never settled that yet. I mean, it's still in limbo to this day.
While you were over in Korea, were you ever wounded?
No, I wasn't. I didn't get a scratch.
You're very lucky.
Yeah, we had, Alviano got wounded. Walter Haiti. Bob Michaels. Poncho got wounded. Bobby Gray, that's five. And then McDonald got killed, and Minnelli got killed. So that was our casualties in our group. That was out of
out of your National Guard unit?
Well, out of the unit, because see, we had drawn a lot of, we weren't full strength when we went in. So we drew draftees, and the majority of our draftees we drew were from either the southern states, like Georgia and Alabama and down in there, or New York.
Oh, okay.
So we had a pretty well a cross section. Had a couple from Chicago area, and but it was pretty well a cross section of people.
While you were participating in these battles and everything, you mentioned that you did a diary. Did you write a diary?
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk to me about that?
Well, I don't know where it is. My granddaughter couldn't find it, but it was just pretty well day-to-day stuff. I mean, unless something really important happened, I didn't, you know, elaborate or anything like that. It was mostly when, when we got our first snowfall, and then, when we pulled up patrol, and it was 40 degrees below zero, and this sort of thing.
So the temperature was a lot different over there than Oklahoma?
Yeah. It was more like Minnesota temperature, or climate, yeah. And of course, the way the Gulf Streams and everything, what they call the Siberian Express, was those northers that came out of Siberia. And, and one unique thing that people didn't realize that at that time there were a few Siberian tigers left in Korea like that were native to that part of the Asia, and of course they were extremely elusive and non-aggressive, not like the Bengal tiger or anything like that. We never saw one. But on occasion, you'd hear one growl at night. And also, they had all kinds, this was a native home to the ringneck pheasant. And we had lots of pheasants. In fact, we killed two or three pheasants.
Would you eat them?
Huh?
Did you guys eat them?
Oh yeah, we'd eat them. They were pretty tough, but we'd eat them.
That's what I was gonna ask, is like, what were your living conditions like? Did you have bunkers or?
Well, we were in bunkers, but they they were dug in and had a big squad tent over there, so they had a roof. And the engineers had used a lot of timber, and they would have these scraps of timber about this long and 12 inches wide and 4 inches thick. So we'd gather up a bunch of those and lay them on our floor like tile. And so we had a wood floor instead of a dirt floor.
You mentioned you had cooks over there too, so they would cook your daily meals and stuff.
Wasn't the best in the world, but it wasn't the worst either. They did ship a lot of fresh meat over there, and we had quite a bit of fresh beef. And then of course we had the C rations and K rations, but this was whenever you went out on patrol. Like, K ration was an individual, and the C ration was for three people. And ironic, your K rations had four cigarettes in them, all had four cigarettes in them.
Goodness. Yeah, that wouldn't happen in today's military.
No, they all had. And of course, when you got those, they had different brands. And people would swap out. And if you got Cools, well, that was the bottom of the list. But if you got Lucky's or Chesterfield's, that was the top of the list. That was the best. Or Camel's. And I don't even know whether those brands of cigarettes are still on the market today or not. Of course, I don't smoke or haven't smoked, you know, in years.
Did you smoke those cigarettes though when you were over in Korea?
No.
Or once in a blue moon?
Not too bad. I usually traded mine off. If I had a cigarette in my fingers, it got in my way, and if I had it in my mouth, the smoke got in my eyes. So I just kind of traded mine off.
And so you were over in Korea for 6 months, and then you came back to the States.
Yeah.
How'd you get back to the States?
On a ship.
What ship was this one? Same kind?
The same, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And so did you stay in the National Guard?
I thought I got out, but when I moved to Texas, right after that, I got a notice that I had only been separated and I still had some months to
finish.
And so this friend of mine who was in the same boat and I worked at the same place, well, we went down and joined the Texas National Guard and stayed in it for about 8 months till our enlistment was up. And so rather than take part in it, they were an artillery unit, rather than take part in their artillery training, what they did, they assigned us to just teaching the new recruits how, manual of arms and how to march and things like that. Yeah.
So your entire military service was about 2 years?
What, about what?
2 years?
22 months active duty, and then about 2 years finishing up in the reserve unit.
Guard unit. What was the name of the unit that you were with when you were in Korea?
It was the 45th Infantry Division, and we were part of the 180th Regimental Combat Team. That's RCT, Regimental Combat Team.
Did you end up going off to college after you had come back?
I took some courses, but as far as actually going to college, I actually got, it's ironic, I got the biggest part of my education after age of 50, because I went back and to Grayson College and took a lot of courses, and then also went through police academy, and I took all of the extended courses from that, like I took, you know, fingerprint school, and took two courses in what they call street Spanish, you know, to talk to the Mexicans, the illegals that you picked up who couldn't speak English.
What part of Texas did you end up moving to?
Big Spring. Then I went back to Oklahoma for a very short time, and then I came back to Dallas.
I saw on here that you were chief of police in Leonard, Texas.
Yeah.
So where's Leonard, Texas?
16 miles south of here, on Highway 78.
And how long were you chief of police for?
8 years.
So what'd you do before you became a police officer?
Well, I was had my own business there, and I had a boot repair shop and a saddle shop and kind of a little Western store, and of course my wife worked in Bonham for Blue Cross and Blue Shield, and so it did that.
Did your military help you with you becoming a police officer? Your military experience?
Well, it taught you discipline is the main thing.
What made you decide to become a police officer?
They couldn't find anybody to fill the unit.
Oh.
And so I had the business, and I told them, I said, I'll do it, but I've got to be able to keep my business too. And so I did both. And
and then you became mayor.
Yeah, I had a heart attack and had to have bypass surgery, and so that's when I got out of the police work. And I'd kind of laid dormant there for several years, and then my wife came home one day and said, they're having a mayor election. And she said, the only one that signed up so far, nobody signed up, was this, pardon my French, was this jug-butted kid that knew nothing from Shinola. And so I went ahead and signed up, and we had the election. I won the election. And ironically, he got 65 votes, and I got almost 400.
Oh, goodness. That's, and so how long were you mayor for?
Let's see, 12 years.
12 years?
Yeah.
Nice. And that was in Leonard, Texas?
In Leonard, Texas.
And going back to your military time, do you keep in touch with any of the fellow soldiers you served with?
Do what?
Do you keep in touch with any of the
fellow soldiers? Oh, yes. There was, we had a reunion every year in Oklahoma City, and I'm the last of our group. We had Bobby Gray, who was from West Columbia, Texas, and John Yurick, who was actually from New York originally, but had moved to Miami, and we became very, very close. Guy Atlantis, he was lived out on Black Island, he died. And and then there was a couple of others that I got acquainted with that weren't in my unit, but I got acquainted with. Because we had a big reunion every year in Oklahoma City, and it's pretty well played out now because there's not that many of them left to come to it. So,
did you join any veterans organization like the VFW or the American Legion?
I was in the VFW and American Legion both.
Do you remember what post?
It was post 111 there in Leonard until we disbanded, and then I affiliated with the post here in Bonham, but I'd have to look and see what the post number is.
How did your wartime experiences affect your life?
How's it supposed to affect your life? Well, I'm very proud of it. I was no hero or anything, but I was proud of the experience. And both of my boys looked back, and neither one of them were in the military, and they said they had wished they had served in the military.
Yes.
Because you got a tremendous amount of veterans benefits that a lot of people didn't realize, that a lot of guys didn't realize. Mm-hmm. And I didn't take all advantage of my veterans benefits that I could. I took advantage of, I didn't take advantage of the education end of it, which I had a good job to come back to, so I didn't. And I sometimes think, well, did I make a mistake there or did I not? But if I'd have gone the other way, where would I be today? And now I know where I am today. But had you gone the other way, you wouldn't have known. Not that it has a big bearing on it, but I think it's Sir Walter Scott said the saddest words of tongue and pen are the words it might have been.
What message would you like to leave for future generations who will hear this interview?
Well, one of the greatest experiences that I think any young person can have, and like I say, is to answer their country's call to arms, serve their country, and come home safely to their family.
What do you feel about the military today?
It doesn't have the discipline that we had back then, and there, it's, I don't know, it's almost like some of it is, but it's hard to describe. Well, first of all, no disrespect or anything like that, but the only women we had were, we never had any up front lines or anything like that, but they were either nurses or did clerical duty, like the WAC and things like that.
Yes.
And now then, I don't know whatever happened, but they said women can serve in combat. Like I say, we didn't have any, we had, the closest we had women in service were back, in Tokyo or Seoul or someplace like that.
Yeah.
Like I say, all our nurses in our MASH units were all men. There were no women in the MASH units at all. And actually, the only women I saw when I was in Korea were USO units that came up to entertain.
Do you remember anybody in particular that you saw?
Well, I remember Betty Hutton. I don't know, probably way before your time, but she was called a blonde bombshell back in the 40s and 50s in the movies. I remember her. And then there were some lesser performers that came through.
Yeah, that's great. Is there anything else that you would like to add to your interview, something that I may not have asked, or a certain situation that comes to mind that you want to share?
Not that I know of.
Okay. It has been an honor to speak with you today, and on behalf of Commissioner Bush and the VLB, we appreciate you taking the time and telling us your story.